This is Talking of Books with Isabel Abuhul, John McDonald, and the rest of the team.
In association with the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
And on Talking of Books today, we are focusing very much on books for younger people. And we're looking at those that have been shortlisted at the moment for the Carnegie Medal. So I'm joined in the studio by Isabel, by Ross, by Heidi, by Shen, and by Alan, me, Yvette. So we've been working our way through the shortlist, and the next one up is The Stars at October Bend by Glenda Millard. And I think, apart from the first one we talked about, which was Sputnik's Guide to Life on Earth by Frank Cottrell Boyce, most of the books this year are aimed at the upper end of whatever children's books cover. And I think, again, this one where we've got the protagonist, Alice, who's 15, with hair as red as fire and skin as pale as bone, but something inside is broken. So she's been assaulted, she has a brain injury, and it's her interactions with Manny, who was once a child soldier. So I think you can tell from that this, again, is a book that raises some dark issues, that looks at relationships, and how the human spirit can be healed. And Glenda Millard, an Australian writer, won the 2009 Queensland Premier's Award for Young Adults and was on the on the list for the 2012 International Board of Books for Young People. So it's quite interesting, actually, how a lot of writers from Australia in particular don't always transfer to the European market, and certainly not to the US market. So quite nice to see them being featured here. I don't know if anybody else has got any thoughts on the Stars of October Bend. Probably one for, definitely, I would say, a much older age group.
Yeah, it's quite a slow read. I think, you know, they don't actually get to meet until sort of halfway through the book, in terms of and obviously she doesn't seem to say very much at all, and he is the one who is translating through her literary prose, really. So it's an interesting read, I think, and one that certainly is worth more study. It's very beautifully and carefully written, and this sense of forgiveness and the sort of passionate way they talk about redemption and heart and humour makes it quite unforgettable. So the recommendation, I think, is that this is something that's a bit more heartrending, and but ultimately it's hopeful. It's another powerful tale, really, about Alice.
So I think there's an excellent shortlist that's come up this year. And should we move on to the next one on my list, which is Philip Reeve, Railhead. And Philip Reeve, of course, was at the festival in March this year, so I think some of us had the joy of listening to him talk about his books. And he's got a whole wealth of material as his back catalogue, and he's won the Carnegie Prize before for He Lies Arthur, which is quite some time ago now. And I'll just throw that quick quiz question in again, which was about Philip Reeve. When Philip Reeve was at the festival this year, he had an illustrator who has worked with him on some of his books. Can anybody tell us her name? 4001, her first name will do, and tell us your name too, and let's see if we can give some books away. So Railhead, something quite different from what we've just been talking about, I think. And I think, Alan, you've read this one?
I have, yeah. Just stepping back a little bit, I find it really interesting that his previous medal was for Here Lies Arthur, mm-hmm. which is a kind of a retelling of the Arthurian myth. When I mostly know him and fell in love with him with science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Mortal Engines?
Yeah, of course, yep. Mortal Engines, the wonderful, wonderful world of Mortal Engines, which in my mind is one of the best science fiction novels written in the last 10 years for young people.
I would agree. And has won awards, many awards for that series.
And it's going to be made into a film, isn't it?
It has. It's just
been optioned. And
Peter Jackson, I think. Lord of the Rings.
Indeed.
Mm. So I think that's going to be an incredible for those who, you know, Mortal Engines, I don't know when it was written, it was at least 10 years ago.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I think everyone will want to read.
I think there's a lot of young adult people out there who are waiting to see how that works on the silver screen.
Yeah. And who will also love Railhead, I think.
I think, yeah, this is, I was really excited when I got the books to see Philip Reeve, and it was the first one I dashed at. But I was also a little bit kind of nervous because he had such a well-established world in Mortal Engines, mm-hmm. and I was thinking, if this is another science fiction, how is he going to create another world where it's not kind of just the same? And he's actually succeeded in this book, I think.
I think
this
so
is
too.
A completely different world. It's fantastic and it's science fiction-y and it's in the far-flung future, and it doesn't look, smell or feel anything like the Mortal Engines world.
Mm-hmm. And if you love trains.
Yes.
The trains feature quite prominently. They're even characters.
Yeah. They do.
Yeah, I really like the retro throwbacks he has here, mm-hmm. you know, because he has locomotives, he has trains. There's a lot of talk on fashion in the book. So there's a lot of kind of futuristic stuff, but he somehow manages to tie it to quite nostalgic things at the same time. It's quite clever.
The central character, I think, is extremely likable. So Zen is the main protagonist in the book, and he's a thief basically, and he's not got much going for him in life, and then he accepts one small task that he's given, and from then on everything changes. One small job.
I think that poverty also features quite largely in this book too, because you're saying he accepts one small job, but that decision's largely pushed by his poverty and his life situation.
Yeah, he has no choices, does
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's also the danger that he is in at the time. I don't think he had a choice, but he very clearly does make the choice, because his choice is, okay, do a job I could be good at, or to get off the train and get arrested by the people I just got out of custody from. Yeah, you know what? I think I'm going to do the thing I'm good at.
Yeah. So. Yeah, he has quite a robust identity, doesn't he? He knows who he is and he knows what he likes and doesn't like. Yeah, and that's another reason I think that I like him, is that he's not vacillating. He doesn't kind of...
decisive character.
Yeah, get depressed or not sure what this means for him. He acts. He moves from decision to decision.
He's a thief, he's a grifter, he's a really engaging trickster kind of character. And he's what drives the book, but it takes you to interesting places that you didn't think it would take you.
Mm. What age group would you be recommending, Alan, for this?
Ooh, gosh, I'd be happily to hand this to a grade 5. I'd be giving this to upper primary school kids who've got a really good imagination, you know?
Yeah.
And another wonderful thing I like about Philip Reeve is you can put it in the hands of a boy or a girl, and it's amazing. He's really gender neutral. There's something magical about how he handles his characters that makes him very engaging.
I would agree. And I've actually recommended this book to people who would not typically read science fiction or fantasy or anything like that, and they have also really enjoyed it and gone on to grab the next one.
I think the power of his writing is in the characters and how well he does characters, and that's why it doesn't matter if it's science fiction.
Exactly.
Another thing I like about his writing is that he doesn't obsess and spend a lot of time going into the technical minutiae of the future's technology
and
trying to prove to the reader that it could actually exist. He kind of just describes it in passing and then just rolls on by and expects you to keep up.
I think that's the advantage of the poverty in the book, is that coming from a character who isn't exactly scientific. He is a thief.
Yeah.
He's going to accept the world as it is, but he also sees the beauty in it that other people might not, which I really enjoyed that. Him seeing the magic of the train, even though it's not magic, it's science, and just how amazing... these trains moving them vast distances in the blink of an eye. It's beautiful. It really captures the magic of how rail probably used to be.
Yeah. I think some ways there is kind of there's a little bit of a road movie feel here, isn't there? You know, kind of traveling coast
I would
to
actually
coast
say train heist.
Yeah,
there's a literal train heist.
I was trying to find the right word. You're quite right, sorry. Yeah, that again, it's a little bit nostalgic. Of that, you know, traveling coast to coast across the Americas and things like that. This is how you see the real country out the windows of a train. There's a lot of that kind of imbued in the story there quite quietly. Mm. It's nice.
Alan, I don't think we actually properly introduced you, so tell us how you interact with children and books.
That's a really big question. Have you got an extra couple of hours?
Okay.
I'm the secondary librarian at Uptown School in Merdiff. And as a librarian, I'm a huge fan of technology, but I'm also a huge fan of all those kind of traditional things that people would think of as a library. So I really see my job as kind of straddling those things and trying to make sure that they all they all fit together and they all interleave nicely, and we can enjoy the benefits of all of those things. For example, when I talk to parents, I'm quite often talking to them about how reading's not dying. A lot of parents are really concerned about how reading's dying, and research doesn't at all bear this out.
Parents should not be concerned because they should be involved in it. It's not a school discipline. This is the mistake that I think sometimes. You can't generalize, but if you think, right, well, I'm sending my child to school, they're going to take care of their reading, they're going to be, you know, they'll be doing all that at school, I absolve responsibility. You can't do that.
Absolutely not. Children are only at school 15% of the whole year.
Yeah.
There we go.
So parents have them for 85% of the time. Now, some of that time, obviously, they should be sleeping. But coming back to what Alan was saying earlier on about, you know, engaging a discourse about books and reading and topics and subjects with the children, it's a dying art, and it comes away from the fact that people are not always dining together in the evenings.
Yeah,
they're
that's really important as well.
And putting the mobile phones away during the meal times.
Not having TV on as a background. And you have to be disciplined. You have to say, no, we're not having... And children actually... If they've had a diet of iPads and television and all of that, it takes a week to break that addiction, because it is an addiction for everyone. And then they find other things to do. They'll get their Lego out. They'll get, you know, they'll start to play as children should play. And then they don't miss it. And
talk as families as well. I think that's the thing, to get the adult and child interaction.
Yes, exactly. The meal times, having meals together when you can, it's really important. And having time where you're not all... disengage.
I think if you have got slightly older children and you want to interact with the ball, actually for me Railhead is a brilliant one, because as I say, I've given it to lots of people, and as Alan rightly says, the characterisation is what makes that novel, and he does it brilliantly.
Heaps of fun in the characters. Lots of spirit and adventure, and they emerge. I think Zen appears quite quickly, but some of the other characters emerge quite slowly.
They do. Yeah,
and so it's quite nice. It's quite tense, and you're waiting for them. Inevitably.
And the joy, of course, is that as soon as you finish Railhead, you can now buy Blacklight Express and read part two.
Yeah, I know. Yes, it's going to be another world.
Keep you going
over
the summer. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with more Talking of Books after this.
From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Danielle Steele, this is Talking of Books.
In association with the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
On Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
So here on Talking of Books, we are working our way through the Carnegie Medal shortlist. And we've just been talking about Railhead by Philip Reeve. I've read it. Alan's read it. Heidi, have you read this one?
Yes.
And enjoyed it?
Yes, quite a bit. I highly recommend it. Good. That doesn't keep me from having criticisms of it, though.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, no, seriously. I felt the character arc, what he learned as a character, I would describe as going from trying to minimize risk while achieving practical goals to having to take risks, larger risks, in order to get something that he wants for himself.
This is a character.
Practical. Yes, this is Zen.
This is an economics review of the book.
All right.
Well, it's also, it is what would you say he learned as a character?
No, I actually have to kind of agree with you, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'm just being naughty.
So that all happens, to me, that happens before the climax. It is a very climactic sequence. It's deeply enjoyable. But there's more that happens after. And I didn't feel that the climactic sequence, while it was, I was invested, I was interested, I don't think it's a bad, terrible thing about the book, but he has to make a rather large decision for all of humanity. In the actual climactic sequence, and his risk-taking learning didn't actually factor into that. The question of, do we expand, do we change, is this life that we have enough for us? I can see parallels, but because it doesn't tie in, we didn't spend the whole book talking about, do we need to expand? Is this life that we are living as humanity a good one, or is it enough? Should we be trying for more?
Jen, that's very deep. Do you think about that?
Well, I mean, just from that perspective, before I move on, the fact that he starts as a risk taker, so I don't think he needs to develop his... I do agree that maybe his character didn't really develop as much, but I think that his character takes a backseat to some of the other characters. But going back to Zen, the fact that he's a risk taker means that he's likely to make that choice in any case, because he's like, well, why not? Let's just go on this wild ride and see where it takes us. But for me, I think the more important characters were the supposedly non-human characters in
I
the book.
I agree with that immensely.
And then you have to, you know, what's great about this is, and wonderful from, you know, like Philip Reeve's move from steampunk to cyberpunk sort of, is that you look at these characters who are supposed to be artificial intelligences. You have, and some are not, and one is not even really human at all. You've got your trains, your sentient trains, who are artificial intelligences. You've got the guardians, who are these AIs who emerged probably around the 20th or 21st century, and they sort of rule humanity. They allow humans to have their little dynasties and emperors just to keep them, you know, opiate for the masses, basically, to keep them happy. But the guardians are the ones in charge, and they're these mysterious creatures who live in you know, like the internet, really. They call it something else in that.
The data sea.
The data sea, exactly. And it's much more like, you know, a sea than a web, because there's so much below the surface. You know, we talked about you know, the internet being the cream on the top, and there's everything below. We don't even know what's underneath. And then you have the Motorik, these androids, and Nova is a main character, and she takes on a much more important role in the next book, Blacklight.
Well, she's a main character, but she's not a point of view character in this book.
No, she's not. But she,
which is why I am talking about the character arc with this, just in the sense of Zen's character arc. He has development. She doesn't. She doesn't have an arc herself.
Yeah, it's in this book, absolutely. It doesn't start yet. Her character development is much more. She becomes much more of a main character in the next book, which
so
takes
he's
you
sort
to
of setting the ground in this one for
exactly
for what is to
well,
come.
He takes a bit of a backseat. In fact, in the next book, you don't know that it's this book is going to take you there.
Yeah.
And then you have the third, you know, the fourth actually sort of creatures who aren't actually artificial intelligences. They're not human at all. They're the hive monks. And they're a composite of insects and a bit of rubbish.
This is the part that I think would be the most frightening to read as a child. Of, that's disgusting!
They have a swarm of insects.
I'm
and
waiting
they,
for the film.
They wear like a robe or something else and a bit of rubbish and all of that, and they move around. But they have a hive intelligence, but if you destroy them, then they just... then they become mindless creatures again until they come together.
Listeners, I think you can tell that within this book, Philip Reeve has created an awesome world. And I think out of the Carnegie shortlist this year, this certainly is the one that's in that science fiction fantasy, whatever you like to call it, realm. Quite different from lots of the other books that we've been looking at. And I quite like to move us on to... now for something completely different moment.
Beck by the late Mal Peake.
Yeah, so Mal Peake. Oh, Mal Peake came to the festival some years ago, and he was with Tim Bowler and David Almond.
Yeah.
And it was so wonderful to actually meet him and his wife Elspeth. And Mal sadly died about 3 years ago now, I think. Meg Rossoff, who again is a fantastic writer for children
Amazing
and young adults.
Writer.
Oh my goodness, she's wonderful. She had a pact with him before he died that she would maybe take on the story which he knew he was not going to finish and finish it. So the book is credited. It's Mal Peake with Meg Rossoff, and it's called Beck. And this was a Sunday Times Children's Book of the Year. Now, I sort of settled myself down on the sofa with this one yesterday. I'm like, by line four, I think I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I've read... you know, Mal's other work, and yes, and it's gritty and it's earthy, and he doesn't shy away from difficult topics, and certainly that shines out very, very clearly in Beck. And Beck is definitely, in fact, it's one of those books where I read it and I think, why is this a children's book?
Absolutely, yeah.
Why is
I
this
think
not just
a lot
an adult
of people
book?
Have said that about Mal Peake's work in the past.
Generally,
it's constantly
absolutely.
A question being questioned.
And I don't and get it, I'll be honest.
I gather that he didn't write with young people in mind.
No,
in fact, the
marketed.
Whole idea of genre to him was rather
That's
bunk,
right.
I think.
It's just marketing, really. I mean, this is for anybody, really.
I
think, for me, actually, is an adult book. I don't, other than that the central character is a child, but then that quite often is the case. There is nothing in this that makes it a children's book.
It has all the things that I would want in a good adult book, yeah. It has interesting social themes, psychological themes.
Yeah, couldn't put it down.
Realistic settings, you know, commentary, interesting commentary, but not pandering, you know, this is you have to read into
there's
it.
No, know, pondering. There's no pondering in here. No.
I have to say, you said that it got you by the fourth page. This one got me by the cover.
No, I said fourth line. Fourth line. Come on.
Oh, the cover is what got me, because I have to be honest, I didn't know this book was coming. And so when I got the little packet of books delivered to me and I saw Mal Pete and Meg Rossoff on the same cover.
Whoa.
It was like...
Birthday.
It was quite a shock to me. How are these two working together? Because they're both such forceful personalities. Mm-hmm. And so I had to have a wee read into it. I had to read about Meg Rossoff and how she felt about finishing Mal Pete's work. And they had such a long-standing sort of writer's relationship.
Yeah, which I didn't know.
Talking
again,
about
until I
each other.
Read
and
into it, yeah.
And, so they knew, and he told her he wanted her to finish it before he passed away.
And they had some discussions as well, I think, before he passed away.
Well, they were meant to meet, weren't they? But sadly, that didn't ever happen.
So they met, and they talked about it, and after he was passed away, then she got together with Mal Pete's wife, and they worked through it, the difficult journey.
Elspeth has worked with him on other books, and I suppose sort of surprised that she hadn't actually taken it on, but maybe it's a little bit too close.
That's interesting.
And you know, maybe stepping aside, having Meg
I gather
get involved
that,
with
that,
it.
That that agreed to it before he passed
that's
away.
Right, that's
yeah,
right.
It was
yeah,
something
yeah,
that
definitely.
I agreed to.
But you can't tell, can you? It's not like it suddenly stops being Mal Pete here and starts being
Meg
or something.
No,
it's seamless.
Well, no, it wasn't, from what I read, it wasn't as in like he was halfway through it. He had chunks that were finished. He actually had the ending finished and things like this. And I read quite a lot about Meg Rossoff and how she felt about finishing it. And I really respect how authentic she was because she said she can't be Mal Pete.
Yeah.
And she realized she couldn't try and write in the voice of Mal Pete. And so what she did is she wrote in the voice of being Mal Pete's friend.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's a historical novel.
Yeah.
So it starts in the early 1900s. It's in Liverpool. We've got an orphan boy who is taken in by a charity. And he was one of the children, and there were many of them who were shipped off to Australia, to Canada. Mm-hmm. He went to Canada.
Yeah, and workhouses and things. Yeah,
and I think it's fair to say he didn't have a great experience, didn't have a great start in life, and it was showing no signs of getting any better.
My goodness, he's got some grit, this character.
He certainly has.
He perseveres and perseveres.
So he doesn't know what his first name is, although you know...
Ignatius, but he never uses
that's
it.
Right. No, so he doesn't he's like just... To be known as Beck, and that's all. You know, he's mixed race. He's got a lot of things that could make his life difficult, and indeed do. But through it all, we've got this perseverance. Shen, you've read this one. Did you enjoy it?
Oh, I did. I mean, the first section really got me, and after that, I was like, oh my god, I don't know if I can go on.
Yeah.
It was very hard to read, but it gets a lot better. And what I love is the way that. I would say this is a fantastic book to do a literary analysis on in school, maybe at A-level or something, because it has these lovely four sections. I mean, it made me think of The Wasteland or Four Quartets or something, T.S. Eliot's. So you've got your water, earth, ice, and fire, and they describe sort of the four important parts of his journey. And it's not just a coming-of-age novel. I would say it's a coming home. It's a journey. You've got your heroic quest, but his quest is to be healed from his very terrible beginnings and what happens in the first section. I mean, your first section, each of them has a different mood. You've got this unsettling sort of feeling in water, and I think we're going to go to a break
we
now.
Are so we're going to come back and finish off Beck and finish off our Carnegie's very, very soon. Stay listening.
From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Danielle Steele, this is Talking of Books.
In association with the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
On Dubai Eye, 103.8. Now, back to the team.
And we are getting to the nitty-gritty of the Carnegie Medal shortlist. And we've just been talking about Beck by Mal Pete with Meg Rossoff, a historical novel which I feel is actually better suited for adults. This is not a book that I would likely recommend.
I would agree. There's
a
little
child.
Bit of language in here.
There is, yeah. So I think, as I say, I don't know why it's children's
older
book.
Older teenagers as well. I think it's okay for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think what you said before about it being a great book for literary analysis also bears this out.
To
really understand this work, you'd have to understand all the other issues that come before it about slavery, social conditions,
abuse
in
child abuse.
England. Why did all these things kind of to understand the bigger psychological issues that he's struggling with, you need to understand all these other kind of historical issues that sit behind it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're not you're always going to understand his journey in a struggle, but you're not going to fully get why this is so
context.
Epic, this struggle that he has.
Especially in the States, wouldn't you have some of that, especially as a child, because in a mixed-race city like Atlanta, for example, it's not like you're unaware of it, and it's not like people aren't talking to you about it, teachers and parents.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you talk about racism and things like that, but there's things that are antecedent to that, such as slavery, you know. Even when slavery was abolished, we still had these situations, these kind of workhouse situations and things, which were tantamount to slavery anyway, that was systemic. And we've also got a similar thing happening in Europe. You know, you've got London sweatshops and orphanages, and how children were taken advantage of and from these economic perspectives, you know. So there's a lot of things that you could get more out of the book if you had this understanding, and that's why I agree with you that this is a great book for literary analysis for
then
older students.
Because you have the chance as a group, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. to actually explore much more the messages of the book.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah. Alan, I think you're spot on that you need for a book like this. For me, you need that background. To come to this goal without
having
any of that
knowledge.
These are
mature issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
Complex.
Yeah. Definitely.
So another brilliant book on the Carnegie shortlist is Salt to the Sea by Ruta, I don't know how you pronounce, Roz, her surname.
Sepetys.
Yeah.
Who comes from a Lithuanian background.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an historical novel. It's early 1945, and a group of people trek across Germany, bound together by their desperation to reach the ship that can take them away from the war-ravaged land. Four young people, each haunted by their own dark secret, narrate their unforgettable stories. They converge in a desperate attempt to board an overcrowded ship in a Baltic port, which is tragically then sunk by a torpedo. It's based on a true story, and apparently was the worst maritime tragedy ever. So I think this is an absolute must-read book. I think that the author has spent a huge amount of time researching it, and it really shows in the authenticity. And it's told through these four people who get onto the ship. And as it goes on, each chapter, as we get towards the sort of, you know, the real disaster time, the chapters are down to one page, one line, and it really has that sense of absolute impending doom.
It's interesting. It's like a countdown.
Yes, like a countdown, like a countdown from when it was obviously torpedoed until, I think it was, what did we say, 9,000 people?
9,000 people.
Of which 5,000 were children. You know,
my goodness, that is a tragedy.
Yeah,
mostly civilians.
Tragedy. So. And we remember, you know, obviously because history has given us so much on the Titanic and other things, but this was a disaster, and you know, a maritime disaster that's just been not recorded really.
I was saying, we, you know, history is written by the winners. We hear a lot more about the perspective of ships sunk, ships of the Allies, the Lusitania in 1917 was it, and some of the others, but we don't hear so much about what happened on the other side.
Lithuania, of course, disappeared behind the Iron Curtain after World War II. So there's a lot of untold history that I think we're going to start seeing more and more of, you know, now as we start to see literature and art and other things come out of from behind the Iron Curtain as these people mature.
Yeah, younger people who are now exploring their own heritage and background and what shaped their parents' lives.
Shaping a new culture for themselves to a modern culture. I'm guessing this book's based somewhat on some kind of family history.
Well, she's originally of Lithuanian heritage, the author herself. But I think she's obviously grown up in the US, and her research, she said, was a global collaborative effort that carried her to more than half a dozen countries. And she sort of credits Claude Pedersen in Denmark, who worked with her for over 3 years on this project.
Wow.
So he read, researched, translated. He travelled to Copenhagen and Brussels. she's got someone in Poland where the ship was sunk off the coast of Poland. So she's really, really done her research. And I haven't finished it yet, but the bits that I've read, it feels incredibly authentic.
I think I've read that it was actually based on a family history.
Yeah.
It's a family connection, wasn't it? She had a cousin who was actually supposed to be of her father's, who's supposed to be on board the boat.
Oh, and then missed it.
But fortune accident near the port meant he didn't actually get on with it. Okay. So
this is something that I find really interesting about books, and something that I am constantly trying to impress on kids at school, is that you get a book and it's got one person's name on the cover. But there's so many invisible people hidden in the back of a book.
Yeah.
People who are researchers and editors and help the story. And there's just like dozens and dozens of people that are involved in a book. And we get one name when we buy it. It's incredible.
And when you
the
think
amount
about
of human it, work that goes into them.
Going back to what, you know, the Howard Jacobson snatching Harry Potter and children's books out of people's hands. How can you do that to a book like this? I mean, how can you say that this is not worthy of adult attention? When, okay, it's marketed as a young adult book. Mm. The research that's gone into it, what she's put into it, how can you say it's not appropriate for us to be reading it, honestly?
I suspect he was looking for some free radio time. So.
say something controversial.
Right, yeah.
He certainly got press coverage with it. Well. I'm not sure it's made anybody go and... go and read one of his books, though. But, I'm not sure he's doing himself that many favours.
I just find that, actually, someone dictating what we should and shouldn't read, I find that obnoxious.
Absolutely.
I immediately picked up my pile of children's books and carried on with them.
I have always loved children's books. You know, I've never forgotten actually what it's like to be a child.
And young adult used, I mean, some of it still is, but it used to be just the best literature you could find, because not only did it have to keep the attention span of a teenager, which is notoriously difficult to do, it also had to be well written. And that has changed because of books that I shall not name.
Yes, I know.
Unfortunately.
Mm.
Yeah. But any listeners who've got a favourite book, they want to tell us what it was, what inspired you as a child, 4001, tell us your name and what book you think as a children's book should still be read by adults, those grown-up people out there. What would it be?
What would it be?
Okay, so Salt to the Sea, Ruta Sabetis, another one, a historical book, which seems to be quite a theme in what we're looking at on the list
Carnegie,
this year.
The thing about the Carnegie list is so much serious things to sort of contemplate.
Living in a society which promotes happiness and positivity for children and adults, it's these books are perhaps not addressing the happiest of subjects.
No, but Railhead.
Railhead is the only one.
Well, they have positive outcomes, each of them. They all have positive messages.
There's hope always. There's always hope.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Beck actually ends in a very good place.
Very good, life affirming.
I was very cheered by that ending, actually.
Yeah. We all like a happy ending.
I know, I do. I've never got out of that, I'm afraid.
As a teenager, your emotions are so part, you know, they're sort of bubbling out of you, that actually everything is, you're sort of on complete highs and sort of complete lows as well. And I think that's why these books are probably, a lot of them are aimed at teenagers, because they are so difficult, and they will leave their mark forever on those that read them. So there's no reason why we adults can't get into it.
One thing I really like about this medal is that it's any book written in English.
Yes.
It's wonderful. It transcends natural boundaries.
It does.
You know, you can come from anywhere as long as you...
Not just English literature, it's literature in English.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And
written
it's
in English.
A good mix this year. We've got Australian, American, British.
Bit of everything.
So it is a good, I think in those terms, a good list, although it's had criticism for other things.
What other things?
I think I'm correct in saying that everybody on here is white. There's no representation from any black writers or
it's interesting.
This is
a very current issue, because there's been a lot of talk about whitewashing and
hashtag Oscar so white, Carnegie so white.
It's already happened. You've missed it. It was when the shortlist came out.
Oh really?
Yeah, that it did get that criticism.
Yeah, but we read the Pulitzer Prize winning book on the Underground Railway by was it Colston Whitehead?
Yeah,
I think his name was. And that was an absolutely, I mean, harrowing, harrowing read. But as I was reading it, I was just thinking, how would it feel to read this if I was black? And of course, I can't get into that. I can't actually ever, I can't imagine because I don't have that. I don't have that history
sort of
going behind. And, you know, these things about people's nationalities, about language, about colour, of course they're important, but you can't expect a prize to be chosen by the colour of the writer.
No, it's an interesting one, isn't it?
And yeah. obviously the characters, however, aren't, I mean...
No, the characters are very, very wide-ranging.
Yeah. You know, in The Bone Sparrow, he's Rohingya, so he's Burmese. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Zen is also mixed race. In fact, most of the world in Railhead in the future is their bit of... Indian and Chinese and everything mixed up, which is, I mean, how you'd expect the world to
be. I think some of the,
the largest populations are Indian and Chinese.
The criticism came that they're not written by people
not
of that ethnicity.
Yeah.
It's somebody
it's
else putting themselves in there.
I think it's a fair criticism. It's a discussion that has to be had.
Yes.
Without a doubt. But we have to be careful that it doesn't become a really black and white issue. For example,
or male
one
or
of these
female.
Authors
you know, you
is
have
Lithuanian.
It used to be, it always used to be how many female, you know, there are no female writers. And then we have the, what is now the Bailey's Prize for women. And there's always an argument, do women need a prize? Are they, you know, second class citizens? And there is a prize for ethnic minorities, isn't there, in England? I can't remember what it's called. And someone, wasn't Mallory Blackman shortlisted on this? And she refused to actually say, I'd take my name off that list. I don't want to be on that. You know, I don't want to be marginalised. I don't want to be marginalised.
Labelled in positive discrimination.
So I think I think it's a time of moving on.
There's a little message. Well, no, there's a little message that's coming that I'm quite loving, actually. Jamie Graham, listening into the show. Malpete was my uncle.
Nice.
So lovely to hear his and Elspeth's names on Dubai Radio and the amazing inspirational work they've done. Thanks, Jamie.
I'm very
Graham.
Jealous of you to have
I
such
know.
An uncle.
So, Jamie, where are you? Where are you listening to this?
Come on to the radio. Be one of our guests one week. We'd love to
Dubai,
have you.
But if you're listening from elsewhere in the world, that's quite awesome. So
no,
thank
I think
you. That's such
Dubai,
a lovely message, Jamie. That's brilliant. And a recommendation for a book, which I'm sure is one that we would all second, is To Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah, so somebody's saying, you know, even now I still pick that up as a book that impressed them.
I just reread that recently,
person.
Actually.
Yeah. It's not disappointed?
No,
good.
Not at all.
I thought you were going to say, and this time round I really hated it.
I picked up the sequel.
I haven't tackled
that. Watchmen.
I've made a conscious decision not to read it.
Well, it's interesting because it got a lot of criticism when it came out. A lot of people were very disappointed how she changed Atticus's character, but I think that they're mostly missing the point. It's not Atticus's character that they're changing; it's Scout's view of Atticus that they're changing.
Yeah.
But I think so many people had a deep personal investment in
Absolutely.
That character that it led to a lot of disappointment.
Well, we've got one more book left, and we're going to come back to that very, very soon.
From Agatha Christie to Jeffrey Archer, we've got it covered. Talking of books.
In association with the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
On Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team.
We're having a fabulous discussion off air. Sorry you're not on air to we weren't on air to hear that, but we will continue. Thank you, listeners, for all your lovely text. The name of the book we were talking about that had the 9,000 people lost at sea was Salt to the Sea by Ruta Sepetys. It is on the forgive me if I've said that her surname wrong. It is on the shortlist for the Carnegie Medal, which will be announced on Monday.
Yeah, so if you want to know any more about any of the books we're talking about, actually, if you go, you can just Google Carnegie and Greenaway Medals and you'll get the website and you'll find everything you need to know.
Yes, yeah. And I think certainly from both of the shortlists this year, the judges have done an incredible job. And I think you could pick up any one of the shortlist and absolutely have a fantastic read. I would say the Carnegie, I think, is very much aimed at the young adult audience because, you know,
But it varies so much from year to year, you know. You can, yeah, it's just whatever librarians are into at the time. And we've got one more book left.
Yes, it is Wolf Hollow by Lauren Wolk. And leading on from our discussion about To Kill a Mockingbird and Harper Lee, the Times of England has said Harper Lee has a worthy successor, a big new talent.
And just
well, the only way we're
right,
going to
Alan,
know
you're
that,
go,
Alan,
you're
going
to have to read it. You're going to have to take it and read it.
Yeah, Annabelle, this is just from the back cover. Annabelle has lived in Wolf Hollow all her life, a quiet place, still scarred by two world wars. But when cruel, manipulative Betty arrives in town, Annabelle's calm world is shattered, along with everything she has ever known about right and wrong. When Betty disappears, suspicion falls on strange, gentle loner Toby. As Wolf Hollow turns against him and tensions quickly mount, Annabelle must do everything in her power to protect Toby and to find Betty before it is too late. Ah,
it's a very gothic title, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the blurb doesn't sound very gothic to me.
No.
But there is a definite link you can see to Kill a Mockingbird in the sort of the subject matter. Yeah, and that's published by Penguin.
Rural relationships.
Yeah. So back to another American writer. So as I say, a good spread across the, not quite across the whole English speaking world, but at least it's nice to see that
Northern
diversity
hemisphere.
Of
definitely. No, we've got Southern Hemisphere.
No, I think we'll find Australia unless it's moved. Just a minute.
Sorry.
We briefly moved Australia.
Interesting about Lauren Wolk. After graduating from Brown University in 1981 with a degree in English literature, Lauren Wolk spent a year as a writer with the Battered Women's Project of the St. Paul American Indian Center, and then worked both as an editor and an English teacher. And now she's at the she's director of the Cultural Center of Cape Cod.
So she spent some real time out in rural America.
Yeah. And this is set in western Pennsylvania, where her family's roots run deep. Both of her parents were raised in that area, her mother on a farm, and in the family, in a family that served as the inspiration for the novel. So again, we've got this real real life coming through really many of the books on
autobiographical
the
autobiographical fiction coming out here again and again.
But you have a writers group, and do you find that as writers you tend to focus very much on bringing your life experience into what you write?
Some of us do, certainly. I think a lot of writers especially do want to think of people, points of view outside of their own. It's sort of what draws us to writing in the first place is learning to empathize, seeing the interior of someone who's not the same as ourselves. But I do think that some of the strongest writing can be when you're talking about from your own experience, because no one else has lived it as strongly as you.
That is true. That is true.
You know best, right? So, not knows another as himself.
No. And we are all very, very painted by what we read, how we view life. You know, reading has an awful lot to answer for.
Note,
can you announce our winners
today? It's going to take a while because Isabel seems to have excelled herself in the number of quiz questions she set.
Okay.
So, was Kate Greenaway an author and illustrator? Yes, she was. And Brian, we'll be in touch with you to let you know how you can collect your prize for that. Well done, Brian. Has Emily Gravett ever attended the Emirates Lit Fest? Yes, she has. And Julia is the one who's come up with the correct answer for that one and been picked out of the magic hat by our producer, Elaine.
I love Emily Gravett.
Oh, so do I. She's absolutely brilliant. And I have got my signed books by her from last time she came, particularly the rabbit one. Who won last year's, who was the children's laureate up until very, very recently in the UK? And that was Chris Riddell. So actually, is it V-I-S-N-E, Veen Barryman, who's nine? We're going to find you a brilliant book to celebrate your win there. Did Carnegie set up over 2,800 libraries in the English-speaking world? Yes, he did. And Manal, a prize will be on its way to you for that one. We'll be in touch. And finally, who came with Philip Reeve to assist him with his sessions at Emirates Lit Fest, or in fact probably to organise them?
I've been waiting
for
this answer. I didn't know.
Yeah. Oh, so that was Sarah McIntyre.
Ah.
So Heba, we'll be in touch with you to work out how you can collect
your
prize.
She's an illustrator in residence somewhere at the moment.
Was it Book Trust? Might have been Book Trust.
Yeah. I mean, she is a fantastic, fantastic ambassador for illustrators, and how they are not always given credit. You know,
they don't always appear on the front cover,
and it's so wrong.
Yeah,
it's so wrong. So
yeah, she speaks.
I'll just get that in there
very strongly for them, and quite rightly so.
Yes,
and particularly when a book has a lot of illustrations in it, and the illustrator doesn't even get credit on the cover, I can see why she gets annoyed. Mm. When I was back in the UK recently, I took a little parcel of stuff to post for Sarah. Drawings by Me, which is run by Lillian here in Dubai. Oh. And they do so much work for us and with us at the festival. And Sarah kindly judged a competition from schools. And Lillian put together a whole package of things which Sarah was thrilled to receive. She had a notebook and a mug and all sorts of things, all decorated with a winning artwork.
Oh, so, that is a brilliant thing.
Oh,
that
my
they
goodness,
do.
It's fantastic.
Yes,
so huge
we've got
thanks
some,
to Lillian.
Some family
for that.
Artwork that came out of Drawings by Me, and it is fabulous. Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's a lot of winners today and a lot of good discussion. But has anybody, we haven't all read all the books, but from what you've heard, would anybody like to pick a favourite book? Mm. Roz?
Well, I'm going for The Smell of Other People's Houses.
Yeah, I think you're the
winning.
Sorry,
you?
I've already put my stake down early.
Okay. Right, that's wrong.
I would have gone for The Smell of Other People's Houses, but I now feel I have to give my vote to the late Mal Peet and Meg Rossoff. I'm going to go with Beck because that sounds my kind of book.
Yeah, I'm
definitely.
With you, Beck.
Definitely. Yeah, I think Beck would probably win it, but I love Railhead.
Yeah, I think I only read two, so I would lean towards Railhead. But I will say Beck is the one I'm most interested in reading out of hearing other people discuss it.
Yeah, interesting. So Beck, although I do think
but
it's...
But we are all adults in here.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So
it's a great adult book.
Read it. And if you think you've got a teenager who you think would enjoy it, and you can discuss it over dinner with them, then that's fine.
Absolutely. Mm. So, for me, the best book here has to be Beck, the one that actually made me think, wow.
In four lines. Yes,
absolutely.
Okay.
In terms of what would I sort of recommend most strongly to a younger reader, that would have to be Railhead or Bonesparrow.
Interesting.
Mm. And Railhead,
Railhead is a great ride, isn't it?
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah. And Jamie, thanks for getting back in touch. And nice to know you're living here. And great to know that you managed to spend some time with Mal and Elspeth when they came to the Lit Fest. How lovely. What a nice connection. And I hope to see you at the Lit Fest, Jamie. Come and say hello. Because, I was also privileged to meet them both then. And,
I remember being on I think maybe moderating a panel with Tim Bowler, Mal Peet, and
David Almond.
And Maith Elkayat.
That was an amazing year for
I think you were
writers.
In the audience. I don't think
I would have been in the
audience. But
yes,
it was
I haven't
a fantastic
got a job with you
thing
then,
about talking
I was
about
enjoying it from
why
the
they write. Why they write and what matters. It was just a fantastic thing. You were on a panel this year. You were
I know. You let me
sense.
On the stage this
yes.
year.
Yeah.
And I'm not gonna let you forget that one.
So
well, what a show
of time. It's been fabulous. What wonderful, wonderful reviewers we've had in today. They have been absolutely amazing. Yvette, would you like to give the roll call of honour?
That's because Isabel's worried she's going to get names wrong. Just putting that there. So to Roz, to Heidi, to Shen, to Alan, to Mary Rose, and to Louise.
I had to help you out. To Louise and to the wonderful Elaine, our producer, and to Yvette for hosting this show so brilliantly with all of her knowledge and expertise as our children's expert. Thank you so much, Yvette. We'll be back next week. I'm reading the book. And it is an incredible book, so incredible I can't remember the name. Can you remind me?
I'll be thinking
it's
of you
Noah Hawley.
I've got the Noah
before
Hawley one.
It is fabulous.
Is
before,
it good? Because I've actually got that.
Before I fall. It is a thriller. And that's why I keep getting late for things because I can't put it down. Right. On that happy note, happy reading to everyone out there. And if you have children, please share some books with them. Mm. Don't forget how important it is. You'll never regret it. Goodbye.
This is Talking of Books here on Dubai Eye 103.8.